It's really uncommon to find a community where you actually feel these are my people and the conversations are here. They're my conversations. These are the sorts of people and the sorts of conversations that I really want to be a part of. And I think that's what the 20,000 people who keep coming back to Sweathead feel. I think there's very few places for people like us that truly represent that sense of, aha, this is it.
What's up? Welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I have Stephen Yap, who runs the research firm Jam Research over in the UK. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, how are you, Mark?
I'm very well. We're going to talk about Sweathead today. You know, that's weird when you do a thing and it exists on the internet, which is a long way from where you live and where you exist in your head, and then people want to ask you questions about it. But we're going to talk about a research project that you helped put together within the Facebook group of Sweathead, which is around 15,000 people now. It's nearly doubled in the past year. I don't really look at the numbers that much. It's like the past 4 years for me, which is my independent life, has been largely about intimacy, finding voice and expressing, because if you don't, no one's going to do it on your behalf. And then some things have been growing. And so we're going to talk about that today. But before we talk about the research project, I wanted to talk to you about two things you brought up before we started. One is you described yourself as a self-employed independent researcher. And I said, no, you run a research company. What's up with that, Stephen?
I do both. And for me, there's no difference in those descriptions. I work for myself. I don't employ anybody. I work with partners and associates, but I don't have anybody on my payroll. But I'm a research company. I can do everything that the biggest research companies in the world can do, more or less. I don't do all of it myself. I can bring in other people. I think that's one of the things about the modern environment, whether it's research or any marketing services, you can tap into communities of expertise and pretty much do what the old vertically integrated agencies can do as a one-man band.
It's funny, just hearing the word self-employed took me back to Australia. I think we use the word a lot, or the phrase a lot, and I was like, hang on, do I hear that much in America? I think someone in America would just call themselves a founder, or they'd say, I'm a CEO. And to hear you say self-employed and independent when you actually have a company through which you operate, I was like, whoa, are you putting yourself down? Is this a bit of British self-deprecation?
No, not actively. Maybe there is a cultural difference there. I think the term self-employed is probably better known in Britain. It's particularly well known at the moment because there's a huge debate. I won't go into the details. A huge debate about government support or lack thereof for the self-employed in the UK. So it's become a term that's been widely used in public discourse. But no, not trying to self-deprecate. Depending on who I'm talking to, I can be anything from a company founder to a freelancer.
Yeah, and the duration for which you get to use the word founder, I think that's another thing that we can get into some other time, because some people have founders for 10 years. And I'm like, at some point, wasn't it founded and it's now post-founding? Why are you still founder?
I think it depends on what you're trying to get out of it and where your motivations are. For me, it was less about the whole thing about owning a business and running a business. I don't get so excited about that. I get excited by doing good work with interesting people and companies. So it's about the work. And if I get to run a business along the way, then that's also good.
Beautiful, beautiful. The second thing you said is that you feel about 10 years younger. Because I have to admit, being on Zoom calls and doing some live streaming, I'm 42 and I feel like 39, 40, 242, I've aged about 10 years physically. You sort of see your eyes. And the thing is, I should have learned this early on, doing Zoom calls with college students. As the person who was always the young, I presented to the Coca-Cola CMO when I was 19, which is like reckless, by the way. But I was always like the young person doing those things, the young person in the management team. And now I'm like, oh no, I'm almost as old as their parents. Not quite. Like, I think there's this weird intergenerational thing when people who write and talk in public are younger than someone's parents, but just old enough to be distant from them, which I think Alain de Botton would probably approve of with the concept that he's talked a lot about, which is status anxiety, where we sort of have anxiety around our own status compared to people who are like us. But if they're distant from us, it's okay. They're not like us. We don't have to compare ourselves to them. Point is, you feel 10 years younger than ever. What did you actually say?
I totally do. And I feel 10 years younger. I feel younger than I was 10 years ago, than I felt 10 years ago. My personal benchmark for feeling young or old was always the tennis players. I remember, you know, in my teens and 20s, and when I became older than the tennis players, I felt, oh, okay, I'm growing up now. And then I became old enough to be the tennis players' parents, and then I just stopped thinking about it. for a long time in my agency career, I always used to benchmark myself against people who were similar age coming up. And if then, I remember the first time my boss, I had a boss who was younger than me, and that was a bit difficult to cope with. And I'm towards the late end of my 40s now, a few years ahead of you, Mark. And the last couple of years, I have just completely thrown all of that away. It doesn't even occur to me. And I think a lot of that has to do with going self-employed, just leaving the corporate world and doing my own thing. Your benchmarks, your frames of reference completely change. And I think as a result of that, age is, you feel old if you think about how old you are a lot. If you keep thinking about your age, then you're conscious of it. And inevitably, as you age, you feel old. I don't just think about it anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's liberating.
Yeah, but are you associating, though, not just thinking about age, like the idea of not thinking about age, blah, 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 my words today. What I want us to understand, though, is are you associating independence with feeling young, which is different to just not thinking about being old?
It's more than that. It's being liberated from always looking around you and say, how am I doing versus these people, or so-and-so is younger than me, and look at what they're doing. Or I feel I have more energy than I have done in a long time, because working for myself and working from home for me personally means I can completely do things on my own terms. I can work when I've got energy. If I'm not feeling energetic, then typically I can down tools. I can manage my time completely, and it's been such a revelation to me. So I feel more energetic. I feel just more on it and on point than I felt in a long time. When I, in my last years of my agency career, I was tired. I was tired for years, 5-6 years, just tired. And you don't even realize how tired you are until you get out of it.
Yeah, there's a real drag, like a spiritual drag that companies place on people because they don't want to allow them to be autonomous, which is kind of largely what you're talking about, that to feel autonomous is one of the main things we want to feel as creative humans. Might be more of a Western idea, I really don't know, but the research I read from behavioral economics about talent, how to get good at stuff, how to feel fulfilled, is largely about autonomy, being able to work out how to do the thing you want to do, self-mastery, and yes, the word purpose, which I know the Brits love to beat up on, but to me, purpose is synonymous with meaning. What are you doing here? What are you trying to get out of the next few years before you're no longer here, right? And so it's really interesting to hear that you associating that in a way with youth, and really what you're talking about is feeling alive and not feeling dragged down. And that's a beautiful thing to feel, right?
Totally. And the other element is discovery. So I characterize youth and youthfulness with discovery, going on a journey, feeling like you're on a journey of progress. And I totally feel like that at the moment, both in terms of the different situation in which I find myself building a business, but also just in terms of work. I have so much more appetite, energy, and excitement for work than I have done in an awful long time.
Ooh, the thing is, like, companies could encourage their employees to feel these things a bit more, to not be such a drag. I don't know if they're culturally set up for it. All right, let's get into the research. And look, I want to give the caveat that it is weird to talk about a thing that you've created, especially the internet things. I've created internet things since the 1990s. And some people who are watching or listening to this will be familiar with when I just record myself walking around a park or just talking into a microphone. They're quite weird experiences for me to do. Like, I don't sit down and go, you know, wow, I think the world really needs to hear from me today. It's largely from decades of not knowing where to put my thoughts and then treating some of those experiences as a way to practice and operating from a place of introversion, trying to like stimulate some sort of social interaction. So it is quite weird. And, you know, when people talk about books I've written, obviously I've written one, some of them are just so like well rehearsed, and like they'll do a 2-hour podcast and every 10 minutes they're like, in my book, blah, 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 and or in my book, blah, 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 or in my podcast. Well, I just, that feels really weird to me. And part of that, I think, is not just the introversion, it's the Australian tall poppy thing where we don't like to stand out. And I know you would relate to that, Stephen. So I just want to put it out there that it is weird to talk about this. At the same time, I realize that there are probably, well, at least 10,000 people a month who are interacting with some part of Sweathead. It's probably more actually, probably closer to 20,000 within the Facebook group, some of the Instagram stuff and the podcast. And so we're going to talk about it. Have I already made it too weird for you, Stephen? I don't know.
Not at all. No, I understand where you're coming from, but I think it's got to be acknowledged. The sweathead's an important part of people's lives.
Thanks. It's an important part for mine. Like, it's literally been key to helping me find an intellectual home, camaraderie, feeling useful. I don't interact in that space where I'm like, I've got to save the world or anything, because I've learned from getting older, you don't save other people. People save themselves. But I like being there and expressing. And it is deeply meaningful. It's weird because it's just out there. It's strange, right? So this research project, I'm just going to interview you about it. We'll probably have a chat towards the end. Like, I'll throw in some thoughts. Why did this piece of research happen, and what happened?
So let me start at the beginning, and it might be useful to just quickly give you a little bit of a personal background. So I discovered Sweathead quite recently, probably to tail end of last year, 19. And I'm not a strategist. I'm a market researcher. The world of strategy and research have a lot in common, but Sweathead is obviously a strategy community. And without going into too much of a tangent, I found it really interesting to learn about the strategy community, of which, despite having done market research for 20 plus years, I actually had very little knowledge. It's a community that, unless you're in it, I think doesn't, there's not a lot of exposure that you get from outside. And it was like me entering a whole new world. And to your points about sharing and about kinship and camaraderie, I've always been fascinated by online communities, because the best online communities give you a lot of what you get from offline communities. They give you that sense of connection, and they give you that sense of belonging. And I discovered quickly, just spending time on Sweathead, a sense of kinship that actually I think is quite hard to find. And there's so many online communities out there, and like all of us, you know, you check into one and you realize that's not very good. Mm-hmm. And it's really uncommon to find a community where you actually feel, these are my people, and the conversations are here. They're my conversations. These are the sorts of people and the sorts of conversations that I really want to be a part of. And I think that's what the 20,000 people who keep coming back to Sweathead feel. I think there's very few places for people like us that truly represent that sense of, aha, this is it. And that means when you find it, it really means something. So within the space of a few months, I found myself spending a lot of time on Sweathead, and spending time, not really, I mean, like most of us, lurking, just reading stuff. But it for me became one of the benchmarks of what a good online community should look like. So time went by, and then around the beginning of summer, June, July time, a lot of stuff was happening in the world. Black Lives was happening. I think a lot of what we saw in Sweathead at that time was a reflection of the wider community, the wider world. There was tension. There was a lot of debate, some of it amicable, not all of it amicable. In some cases, tensions were running really high, tempers were being lost. Some people were posting things that were inappropriate. As a relative outsider observing it, it was an interesting place to be. And particularly as a privileged person in London, a long, long way away from the heart of Black Lives Matter, Sweathead, regardless of the fact that it's for people who typically work in a certain discipline, actually, I have to say I learned more about Black Lives Matter from Sweathead than any other place, any other source. I got a lot of insight as to what it was all about, and insight that I wasn't able to get from the TV or any of the people I was talking to in my other relationships. So the opportunity came about. I think I responded to a post, one of your posts, Mark, where I think you were looking to establish some ground rules, some sense of, okay, that we've had a difficult few weeks here in the group, and what do we do next? And you posted up the idea, maybe we should do some research. So I responded to that, really not knowing where it would go. And from that, we conceived this piece of qualitative research, and that was in the end of June, early July, almost 5 months ago. Yeah. And so for me, it was very much a snapshot in time. It was about what was happening in Sweathead at that moment in time. But I think the learnings from the research very much have a longer shelf life than that. And for me, it was also more than what was going on in that particular moment in time. For me, it was actually an opportunity to study and understand the dynamics of online communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the only other history that I'd add is this, that so by the time that you did this research, Sweathead was about 2.5 years old. I think I started it around the start of 2018. I was doing talks. I did a whole bunch of free talks because I was trying to find my voice. Like the workshops and workouts I did maybe 8 to 10 of them from San Diego up to Vancouver through LA, Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, Eugene, a bunch of places, and launched the group and launched a podcast, Super Lo-Fi. Richard Shotton was one of the first ones. He's published a great book on behavioral economics. And like I said, it was 2.5 years and I'd been around, like I used to run a hip hop message board and we'd have tens of thousands of people a long time ago come in. It was Super Lo-Fi. And that community there can be physical repercussions if you misbehave online. And so I grew up around that, right? And so when I started to see some of those dynamics appearing a bit in my group at Sweathead, which is advertising, I was like, what is this? But also, I didn't interact with the group that much. I didn't want to be spamming people. I didn't want to be like moderator. And so for 2.5 years, barely blocked anyone, deleted anyone, let most people in. It's a private group. Was not moderating many posts unless they were spammy. And then a few posts set off pretty big reactions. And I don't really want to go too much into the posts without the people here to talk about it. But there were some posts that sort of characterized the process in the US as riots. And one of the questions was like, how would you solve, what would a strategy be to quell the protests? Or sorry, what would a strategy be to quell the riots in the US? And if you're not in the US, perhaps, right, you don't understand that those words are quite loaded, historically very loaded, because when people are fighting for their rights, people who want to suppress them would, instead of referring to them as protests, they call them riots and they try to quell them and send the police in and people would die. And that was kind of what was happening. And so that post triggered a lot of interaction. And for a few weeks there, I spent maybe 10, 20 hours a week actually speaking to people on the phone, people who were flaring up, because I've seen this stuff happen in different communities. Community behavior, I don't think, is a natural state of affairs in advertising. And there are a lot of other beautiful communities out there. Some have come and gone and some last within advertising. It's not natural. It's a super competitive industry. A lot of people look down on each other. They look down on people who care about advertising or who care about strategy. I see and hear this stuff all the time. But the point is that up until you did this research or helped all this research happen, it was largely an untouched space. By that time, maybe 9,000 to 10,000 people. I don't have growth numbers. It's just like, let's just, whatever happens, happens. It's fine. And so then we decided to do some research to work out what was happening, because I think what was strange for me is that online communities have often satisfied needs for me, which is feeling a bit of an outsider, not feeling that I have a lot of people in my life who care what I think, hence online communities. And so I was getting feedback around the time of the how would you quell the riots post that Sweathead was not a safe place. It was didn't feel safe for people who weren't white men and all these things. And I was like, oh, hang on. I didn't even really think about it because I wasn't policing it. And I always identified as an outsider who didn't fit in anywhere. And so not only over the years is it strange when people want to talk to you about a thing you do, like a thing with a name like Sweathead or a podcast or a book, but now increasingly people in good and not good ways start to project you're a white man onto me immediately. And I was like, okay, I got to slow down and think about this. What's going on? So put the call out. Tell us about the approach to the research. What was the methodology? What questions were we asking?
So we started to do some qual research and came up with a set of questions, open-ended questions, and we put the call out on the group for people to participate in discussions, and we ended up with about 100 people. So thanks to everybody if you're listening for your time and taking part in that. And we grouped everybody into smaller groups by time zone and essentially asked them to group together on video calls and debate the questions and to capture the key points and then submit them back to us, which they duly did. And it generated a massive amount of really, really good insight and fantastic quotes. And I think some of it we were expecting because obviously we were in the group and we were experiencing it at the time. Some of it was still probably quite surprising and eye-opening to hear. Some of it was quite specific to that time, may or may not still be as appropriate or relevant today. And some of it definitely is appropriate and relevant today. And I think it's, you know, there's some of the really interesting learnings there about Sweathead, specifically about advertising and what it's like to work in advertising. Again, I'm sort of an outsider. I am, and I'm not. I've worked for WPP a couple of times. I know what that world's like. The research world isn't a million miles away. Research agencies aren't a million miles away from advertising agencies. But as a relative outsider, it was fascinating to me to hear what, you know, and to learn what life is like from the people who are inside. And more broadly, I think it's for me a case study in community dynamics. What happens when a bunch, you know, of incredibly smart, opinionated, some of whom are vocal people, get together? And of course, Black Lives Matter and the protests in the US were a little bit of a lightning rod, I think, for those dynamics to come to the surface. Dynamics that are always there, but probably are hidden most of the time. And it takes something like that to bring them up. And in a way, I think it's not a bad thing that people, you know, people voice these things that perhaps, you know, they don't, for whatever reason, feel the opportunity to in other times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So the only other context I would add to before we get into what you found or what we found, what the 100 people who kindly gave us time, the only other context I'd add is that I've probably met maybe thousands, at least hundreds of people in the group face-to-face, or DM them, and or they've joined Zoom calls, coaching sessions, all kinds of things. So I often have multiple touch points. That's a weird thing to say. I often have multiple touch points with the person. And also I often see people and how they behave across multiple channels. So some people might be having outbursts in one channel, and if I see it in another one, or if I then get a really long email, I'm like, okay, either this person is going through some stuff, or I want to be compassionate to possibly a mental health situation. And I really do try to approach things. And again, people be like, you're a white man, white supremacy, you're sexist. I get this stuff, like I get taken down all over the place, little pieces of criticism here and there just because of how I look by people who don't know me. And I'm like, no, I'm not really, like, like, do what you want, just don't be assholes to each other, would basically be the rule. But I do see people across multiple channels as well. And so it's sometimes unusual when some you might know someone and then there's a lashing out and you're like, whoa, where did that come from? Is that something going on in their life? In which case, let's be compassionate. Is it something that's more of a long-term issue? Could be mental health or long-term life situation. Let's be compassionate. But at some point, if it becomes destructive, and they're acting out of malicious intent, or you think they are, that's harder to get involved with. And what I found this year is, like, I assume good intentions, and every now and then I just run into like a brick wall, and that brick wall is just, it just wants to slap you because brick walls have hands, right? And then you're like, oh, that person's actually possibly malicious. Like, that's what their setup is. Point is, operating from compassion, and I often see people in multiple channels, including in real life. And so I try to be slow with the judgment in a way where other people might be quick with the judgment and quick with the lashing out and reaction.
Let me just pick up on that one, Mark. I think that's evident. The compassion is really evident to people in the group. And I think that's one of the reasons why the group is as successful and thrives the way it does. I found it interesting to hear your intro that prior to earlier this year, you thought you were pretty hands-off because I would imagine others would actually beg to differ and say that you were pretty hands-on in a good way. And of course, since June, July, you've become more hands-on. But I think what one of the things that differentiates Sweathead from other online communities, in my opinion, is not just the quality of the people and the quality of the conversations, but actually the time that you spend on it and the fact that you actually nurture relationships, genuine relationships. And I appreciate you do that as a matter of the other, you know, as a function of the other Sweathead activities that you do. But I think that's one of the things that makes the group great. It's not just a bunch of anonymous people who have no connections with each other. These are real people, and actually you work to foster those genuine connections at a personal level, as well as very clearly spending time in the group and active in the group, which a lot of people don't. And no. I think that's direct, you know, has directly contributed to the ongoing success of the Sweathead community.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, when I say it's super weird talking about this as well, because in my head, I'm doing this Aussie self-deprecation thing, which is like, it's not that good. You're not that good. Who are you to be talking about this? When in America, what I learned was I just say, thank you, Stephen. Thank you. This is honestly, I learned this stuff in my late 30s. That's how drilled the Australian culture is into me. But yeah, no, it was pretty hands off for 2.5 years. I'd post stuff. I didn't want to be spamming people, but I didn't have a content calendar. I had no goals. I still don't have like goals around numbers, because to me, I kept coming back to what I was doing this for, which is I talk about strategy to talk about the deeper stuff. I just happen to know that strategy and strategy communities, they aggregate a lot of people that I like. And the past 2 years, I was fortunate enough, especially the past 2 years, was fortunate enough to, I don't know, 30, 40 cities around the world. And the conversations I would have with people in this industry, and especially the strategy folk, the researchers, it's almost the only place in the world that I have those conversations. And I was like,
totally.
I really value this.
Yeah.
And how good is that? Because the rest of my time, I mean, you know, I live in Manhattan. It's basically a big office with a bunch of shops, right? Like, I'm not walking around the street having these amazing conversations about stuff. You could find it, but it's not there. And I went back to Australia last year. I love you, Australia. I feel super alienated. I talk about anything like this and people say, you're so deep. And I'm like, I feel like you just like put a hand in my face and push me away. Like, I don't know what else to do or what else to talk about. I could totally talk about sport and martial arts and all that other stuff, but this is my group. This is my people. And I'm not saying that in a way that's obsessive or like a fetish. It's just like, I love the people here and I feel like they're capable of so much. And yet I know that a lot of them who are sensitive are going to get bullied, bossed around, possibly in their own personal relationships, let alone in the workplace. And it sucks because we've all, like a lot of us have gone through it, and it'd be better to, you know, maybe not avoid it, but to come out of it with a crew around you rather than thinking that you're broken, because a lot of us also have that narrative. So I'm talking too much, but I just did want to give some of this context because I've not talked a lot about this stuff like this in public. But shall we get into the questions? And is there anything about the methodology that you thought was interesting?
It was done, obviously, you know, without any budget supporting it, but it worked really well, actually. And if I say so myself, we convened the groups. The group was self-organized, and we gave people a deadline to submit in writing their findings. And we did that through a Google Forms, and it worked really well. I think, again, the credit to the people who took part. The quality of the write-ups was, on the whole, tremendous. Mm. Just fabulous insights, and you would imagine that you'd get that from a team of strategists, but it's still pretty amazing when you see what comes back.
It's nice to see it, and just apologies it's taken so long to kind of get to this point. Apologies to you, apologies to everyone who did it. I did kind of burn out getting I published a book, and I was doing 100 classes in 100 days. And a lot of rough news with friends and family, and my emotional resilience. You know what? It is there. No one's going to take that from me, but I'm good in bursts. And I kind of kicked this off. I kicked a few things off around this time, and then I sort of, summer ended, and my body was like, my soul started to feel a bit worn down. I'm still trying to come back from it, to be honest. So apologies, but thank you for your patience. What did you find?
Well, where should we begin? Should we start by talking about the advertising industry? Mm-hmm. So we asked sort of big questions, and then we drilled down these quite specific ones. And the first question we asked, I'll read it verbatim. What are the biggest issues facing people who are working in or want to work in advertising or in an adjacent industry, marketing, research, etc.? And there's just pages and pages written on this. And interesting, I think it's fair to say that strategists can be particularly self-flagellating, and that was definitely coming through in the findings here, but I think in a constructive way. And I'll come on to the positives later. It's not all negatives, but there are some real, you know, there's clearly some real challenges, I think, if you're working in an agency, if you're working in a strategy role. You know, some of the themes we're seeing, it's not a professionally recognized discipline. Everyone thinks they're a strategist or wants, you know, thinks they can do strategy. You know, there isn't a set of established professional standards, role definitions, expectations. People tend to be self-taught on the job. People feel quite isolated. So I think this, again, part of the reason why people turn to the group, you know, a lot of people are working without much support in agencies that lean on them, and they haven't got anyone to lean on. So they come to the group for their support network. So, but that sense of isolation, I think, is a really, really powerful theme that comes through. And some of the things you said earlier, Mark, I think probably add more context to that. I think generally, as strategists, and I'd say the same is true of market researchers, similar personality types you'll find in both of those, both of those disciplines, highly inquisitive, analytical people who are probably more than averagely self-critical, and I won't say lacking in confidence, but they certainly, you know, will think before they speak. And I think the fear that you're the emperor's new clothes, the fear that you're not really doing your job, and the fear that what you're doing is not built on something substantial is one that we all recognize with, you know, in strategy and in research.
Yeah, I love that word recognize, because you can use it in a few ways. I think a lot of people who do this work, and what we're talking about, we are describing people who happen to be in an online community about strategy. We're not saying that you have to be these things or have these traits to be a strategist or a researcher or a thinker. Look, I've worked with, you know, probably 100-ish planners in different countries and interact with a lot of people, so I kind of have a feel for it, or read a bit about psychology, a little hobbyist there, so I have a feel for it. But you don't have to be these things. I think if you're an extrovert and you don't like analyzing things and solving problems, you're not really going to work out in what we do. But the word recognize, I there's got to be something in so many people who do strategy or account planning or research who in some deep way are actually seeking like recognition of themselves and who they are. Those professions or that work does attract people who are a bit outside, who are trying to find a way in maybe, but often, and it's, I'll use the word stuck, that often they can get stuck for decades just being on the outside looking, as opposed to being front on the stage, making something, designing something, painting something, whether or not they've got the skills for it. So there's a bit of an observer, like a safety blanket, I think, there as well. But they're often seeking recognition. And if they're empathetic, they might try to get recognition from bosses and from partners. And guess what? Probably won't get it, because that's how they chose their mating situation or their working situation.
Right. So given you do have in this industry people who perhaps haven't necessarily found their people elsewhere. These are people that perhaps have gone through their lives feeling like they're a little bit on the outside. They don't necessarily belong. These are people who, we are people who will question things. We'll question everything, and we'll question ourselves, and we'll question everything every day. We'll question, what are we doing, and are we doing the right thing? So naturally, this comes out in the research, but there are some, beyond that, there are some, you know, genuine structural challenges working, you know, in agencies and in strategy. There's, you know, the pressure on time. There's never enough time. There's been every month in Sweathead, there's a thread that goes along the lines of what's the shortest amount of time you've ever been given to turn around a brief? And I think it ranges anywhere from hours to 3 days if you're lucky. The you know, the pay.
We've all had 30-minute briefs, don't you worry.
The pay certainly doesn't reflect. I mean, this is not exclusive to strategy, but the pay certainly doesn't reflect the hours or the expectations. More broadly, there are some organizational challenges, shall we say, the lack of diversity and the elitism that exists in agencies is something that comes through a lot. Lack of role models, both particularly within strategy, but more generally. I'll pull out some quotes. You know, there's a bro culture that goes on. There's a lot of sense of entitlement instead of pushing for true creativity. Elitism at its best, ageist, sexist, racist, really hard to get into unless you know someone or if you have connections. There's a lack of roadmap for how to get through the system. The rebranding of planning as strategy has made the landscape more confusing. It implies there's an end goal. This is quite nice, I think, and quite thought-provoking. The rebranding of planning a strategy implies there's an end goal in the conversation, which makes the process difficult, as a strategy is a deliverable or a product, which it isn't. It is something that underpins all aspects of the process. Self-indulgent navel-gazing. Living too much in the now, flip-flopping too quickly. Campaigns turned out such a frenetic rate. So many changes in nuance of messaging. There's no consistency or continuity. And there's a lot of frustration coming through. You've got people who want to do good work, but they haven't got the time. They're under pressure to deliver things without the opportunity to really give the headspace to it. They're trying to be strategic in a tactical world.
Yeah. There's a lot there. With the first point around recognition, I just wanted to close that off, which is like, if you're running an agency and you've got strategists, try to recognize them every week. If you're managing strategists, try to recognize them every day. Use that word recognize. Have I recognized that person today? Because that's what a lot of people want. Don't do it in a manipulative way. Do it in a genuine way, or as genuine a way as can happen within a employer-employee situation. But that word recognize is super important, because increasingly, people are burning out. The industry is getting a good shake-up right now, and it has for the past decade, and people want to work for good people, people who will recognize them and appreciate them. So I think hold on to that word, recognize. What you're talking about, there's so many themes with what you're talking about there as well. Like the planning of a strategy, I've read about the origins of account planning and why it was called that. It always felt like this weird English affectation thing. It's like, what the hell's that? Strategy, more American, and I think like a lot of job titles and the number of job titles, again, over the past decade, because I used to see, you know, creative directors who were like the head of the office go to Cannes, and then all of a sudden the following year, there are a few extra job titles. ECD would appear, and then CCO would appear, because they wanted to be able to sit at a table with people from other regions and compete and be clear about who was, you know, important in the status. So, these titles, I think planning to strategy, or the labeling of planning to strategy, has definitely confused it. Everyone does think they're a strategist. The navel-gazing one is also easier to get into than elitism and lack of diversity, etc. But I think we shame ourselves a bit for thinking and being navel-gazing. It's totally fine. Also take action. If you're just having the same conversation again, boring. But often I see people like shaming strategists for thinking about strategy. It's just not cool. Like, you wouldn't do that to a doctor. You wouldn't do that to like a football player or something. It's ridiculous. But as long as it's not the same conversation and that you're trying to move and change something, I think that's okay. Elitism, lack of diversity, lack of role models, the vagueness of planning, they're huge topics. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think, as you say, this is not exclusive to advertising. However, there's right now in November 2020, there's at least on the feeds that I'm a part of, there's a huge amount of debate on the gap, the lack of representativity within the marketing and advertising industries of the people that we're trying to advertise. Every day on Twitter, someone posts up, here's what advertising people think, and here's what actually the wider world thinks, and you know, can look at the big difference. And I think there's something there. I won't dwell on the bigger representativity piece, but I certainly understand and have a lot of time for the feeling that it's a discipline that's hard to get into to begin with. And then when you're in there, it's not necessarily one where progression is easily understood. Where do you go? It's one thing if you know, you might perhaps be lucky enough to work for an agency that has a fantastic CSD and you know exactly what the roadmap looks like to become one of those, but that probably isn't most of us. It's probably not most of us in Sweathead. You might be a one man or one woman strategist, and where do you go? Where do you go as a strategist? What do strategists do when they grow up? And how do you demonstrate your value to the organization so that you can argue for progression or whatever that looks like to you, whether it's more money or whether it's bigger responsibilities? I think a lot of what we're seeing in the research is that a lot of organizations have not created their progression roadmaps in a way that is good enough, you know, for many strategists to feel like it's a legitimate career.
12 years ago, my first full-time planning role, 50% it was digital work, like user experience information architecture, was at Leo Burnett. I was a planner. My boss was a planning director. I don't know if there was anything in between. His next role was CEO. Like, the thing is, like, this HR trick of having all these levels that you got to strive for, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know. I think it is important if everyone else is doing it, because we're comparing ourselves to other people at all times. But also, it is a form of materialism, and it's not to say that it's wrong. It's just to be aware that you're playing a game, and that game is a game of materialism and comparison. And you're going to work in agencies holding companies that will have like hiring freezes and salary freezes for years, especially if they're French. And so like you got to be aware of these things and work out what you're doing here, and also not to try to find everything within one career in one particular industry, because I think sometimes when we're young, we give away a lot of our power and our authority, especially the word author in authority, we give it away to a career hoping that it'll show us the way. And it's like, that's your work to do as well.
There's another point here which is worth raising, and there's the feeling that as strategists, our job is to tell the truth. You know, we've been told to give the unvarnished truth, and it's very much the same in market research. You know, you're paid to tell it as it is, and yet often the external environment doesn't actually support that. You know, it's the few good men. You can't handle the truth. Where people actually they don't speak up, and you know, there's navel gazing from a self-flagellation perspective, but there's navel gazing because actually you realise that there's repercussions if you go off the beaten path. If you're seen as a maverick, that's not a good thing.
No, totally. Have your truth, keep it to yourself. If there's an Overton window, a spectrum of truths you're allowed to talk about, but if you're always telling the truth, a few things will happen. One is you won't last, and two is people will take advantage of it, and three, you'll expect it from other people and they won't give it to you. Like the new business team that sat on the pitch brief for 3 weeks and it's like, oh, we need to respond next week. It's like, why didn't you tell us? Or the account team that makes up deadlines for you to respond to, or the client that wants the truth but doesn't want it to their face in a presentation. Yeah, that can cause a lot of conflict, and it's hard because yes, you can become more diplomatic, more politically aware, worry more about your optics. Mm-hmm. But then what's the job? Is that the job? Because that's not what a lot of us thought we were getting into. They didn't give us that lesson on day one. This job's actually about politics and not about finding out real things. And you must find that a lot in your work as well, right?
Oh, totally, of course. And that's one of the reasons many of us choose to leave agencies, because we want to get back to the truth. That's no disrespect to people. I know many very, very capable people who thrive in agencies. They just have a different skill set.
Mm. And as we heard earlier, the truth makes you 10 years younger, right?
Or it does for me. It did for me. Truth sets you free and makes you younger.
It does. All right, next one.
Let's go on to some of the good things. So that's that. You know, those are some of the negatives. So what are some of the best things about working for advertising? Learning for a living. I think we can all identify with that. You know, as sweatheads, we love knowledge. We thirst for knowledge. We exist to accumulate knowledge, and to be paid to do that is pretty awesome. To be around people like us, I can't emphasize this more. I think it goes for the group, but it also goes for being able to work in a discipline where you're actually surrounded by people who are like you, because these people are not necessarily easy to find in the world. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily meet people like this on a daily basis. So when you have the opportunity to collaborate with other people who are like you, who are equally or even more hungry for knowledge, who are smart or as smart or even smarter or as creative or more creative than you, that's truly a wonderful thing. And the opportunity to have some intellectual freedom, you know, with the caveat that we talked about, where freedom isn't always recognized, isn't always appreciated in a corporate environment. We're not doing life and death things here. We're not making decisions that about health or about medicine. So there's a certain amount of freedom that comes with that. At the end of the day, it's advertising.
Yeah, it is really rare to meet people like this, and it's even rarer to meet people like this that you're not competing against in a very visceral way, because obviously psychologists could say we're always competing. But you're not like pitching against them. And like I said, took me to around the age of 40 to really realize that in a deep way. And that's from talking to people in Stockholm and Sao Paulo and Vancouver. I'm like, oh my God, Toronto, like, oh my God, why don't I have these conversations all the time? And then, maybe I could have them more often. That'd be good, wouldn't it? And maybe that's going to happen online.
Absolutely. I think the weirdness for which we often feel like we are punished or rejected in the outside world becomes a strength when we're surrounded by equally weird people. You know, here's a quote: strategists are weird people with weird brains, and advertising, you know, strategy is the quirkiest job in the business world that allows us to use our weird brains in weird ways, in ways that actually people appreciate, with people who get us. And that's a powerful thing. When you find that tribe, when you find that group of people who think like you, work like you, and you can activate that in a way that then generates an outcome, a campaign, a piece of work, that's tremendously rewarding. The constant learning, the constant training, the constant application of your cognitive skills, I think is something that gets a lot of us up in the mornings.
Totally. I totally agree. Next.
What are the main reasons for people to be a member of and contribute to this Sweathead Facebook group? So let's get into this. We talked about some of these themes already. And I think to a certain extent, the Sweathead Facebook group is a 20,000 person strategy department. It's your strategy department around the world. And people use it for different purposes, but I think everybody gets the sense that this is my people, this is my tribe, and this is my community. So it's a problem shared, right? You get to share your problems with people that understand your problems and might actually have an answer to your problems. And that's particularly important when you live in a world where actually you don't have many people outside of that Facebook community to share with. You then get the access to different point of views. I personally got a lot of out of that, being in the Facebook community, just listening, reading, sometimes interacting with people just from a completely different place and understanding how they see the world. And that's incredibly valuable because, once again, I don't think necessarily there are that many places, either on or offline, for us to actually do that with people who can truly articulate. And that's, that for me is what distinguishes Sweathead from many other communities, is the quality of the articulation. So it's as someone called it, it can be the Wikipedia of strategy. It's your ear to the ground. It's your inspiration. It's the sense that you're in the know and you can see different and learn from different perspectives. You get a sense of validation. Some people get a sense of validation. The idea that you can ask questions. You can ask questions that maybe you couldn't in the office because you don't want to look bad because you're the one who's supposed to have the answers. So you can ask questions in a safe way. It's also the only place, and I quote, where a rant will find resonance. People actually understand what you're ranting about. So that sense of kinship, people who get what you're all about, that feels good. There was mention of how great the conversations with strategy people can be, and the best about those conversations being how they can be dangerous. They can take you to illuminating places by walking very closely through things that are difficult to talk about. We saw a lot of that just before the research happened. We saw conflict, we saw argument, we saw things that crossed the line, but we also saw a lot of incredibly powerful illuminating discourse, I think, around the things that were happening at that time, from which I know a lot of people, got a lot of insight from.
Yeah, I agree. The one thing I just want to point out, so I appreciate your words and other people's words about Sweathead, but I do want to point out that there are a bunch of other really great communities out there. So the APG, the Account Planning Group's obviously done a lot of amazing stuff around the world, not as much online. And I think they've been wrestling, when I observe them, and I was on the committee of the APG when I was about 30 years old in Australia, but I think they often wrestle with being more establishment versus the sort of young rebellious attitude that can come through. And I think in different parts of the world, they're adjusting to being a little bit more, don't sue me, a bit more modern and frank. There were probably topics they wouldn't have touched 5 to 10 years ago. And now, because of the work that all these other communities are doing, they're starting to open up, which is beautiful. And we should celebrate them for it, because I think professional organizations, they probably have more to lose than us. Open Strategy is amazing. Ladies Who Strategize is amazing. Natalie Kim does a lot of beautiful work. Planning Dirty, Julian Cole, they do a lot of beautiful work as well. Rosie and Farris have a community. I know I'm forgetting one, the Account Planning Group in Facebook. There's a lot of them. Sorry if I forgot a couple that I'm familiar with. There's a place to play. Like, I don't think of these, like, most of them are friends. I don't think of us competing, although totally people give me competitive energy. And I'm like, whoa, where did this come from? Okay. Little sub-tweet, little sub-LinkedIn post. Okay, fair enough. I just wanted to point that out. But the dangerous conversations is interesting. One of the things that I know that goes on is that some people have bosses in the group, and so they're a bit nervous about communicating. So there can be a bit of a stalemate, and there can be a bit of a watching that's going on. Or some people, like salespeople from very well-known organizations that sell to all of us, they come in and they lurk and they watch. And, there's a bunch of different behaviors going on that are less obvious, but I find out about them.
So I I'm a part of some of those communities that that you've mentioned, and it occurs to me that strategy, in some ways, as we talked, as we've mentioned, is can be a job that feels very isolating, but in other ways, it's not. Strategy seems to have spawned some fantastic communities. I can tell you, market research doesn't have anything like that. What is it about strategy and strategists that have given rise to these fantastic resources and these networks?
I wonder if it's possibly to do with the average age of strategy folk, maybe being younger than market research, maybe less to lose, maybe more digitally native, more digitally savvy, perhaps more empathetic. Market research, you're going to get people from academia or academic backgrounds. And if you've done a PhD or a master's, you've either done that because you're more disagreeable. Yeah, big five personality traits, I get the A in there, A, agreeable, disagreeable. So a lot of people who go through the rigorous academic process are more disagreeable, maybe more competitive, maybe more pernicious. Is that the word? You know, maybe harder to bring together. Those communities exist, but if you're going to build a community, you got to commit to it. A lot of people are like, yeah, I could do a podcast. I could do a community. And they're like, okay, for 10 years? Because otherwise don't do it. Like, what are you doing it for? Mm. And so that then means that the establishment organizations that get funded by companies do it. And then it's always really stilted. You know, you see conferences by some of these organizations. This is not blanket, by some organizations in market research or strategy or advertising. And it's like, who came up with the theme of that? Who wrote the titles for those panels? Nobody talks like that. You know, like how to dominate the omni-channel growth hacking future of holistic synergy. And you're like, what? So this doesn't answer your question, but I think it's younger, more digitally oriented, less to lose, maybe more frazzled. Maybe there's groups of these people who are more isolated and who don't take themselves as seriously, although a lot of us do.
I think that's right. I think there's a couple of things I'd add to that. I think the connection with culture is a key part of what creates this sense of dynamic connection and community for strategy, because of course strategy is ultimately, it's about culture, isn't it? They're so connected to culture, and research can be, some forms of research can be, but compared to strategy, there isn't that sense of direct connection. And so every conversation can be a relevant conversation in strategy. And that's not necessarily the same in research. And the other thing I would say, there's so much in common between the two disciplines and the personality types you find in the disciplines. But researchers tend to be super, super cautious, and they have their opinions, but they'll keep them to themselves. And that's it. That's one of the often criticisms of the researchers is that they don't actually give any opinions. They'll just tell you, they'll tell you the what, but they'll not tell you anything of the why.
Yeah, there's something, if I think back to my 20s, right, I found that the outside researchers that came in were often older, more careerist, more aloof, more serious, more earnest, trying to be right, and just difficult to know. Every now and then a client would find someone who might have had an interesting background, who was a great market researcher, but also kind of got the agency vibe as well, and then you would have great relationships. But often it felt combative and standoffish and aloof. But that's just going back a long time ago. But they're the stereotypes that I think I could find a few people to agree with those stereotypes. And it's not that they're right or wrong. It's not that they're mean or kind. It's just that was the vibe. It's like, oh, we're going to go to this thing again. And also, having done research projects with formal market researchers, sometimes you hear the truths and then they don't really report them back, or they use language that's not going to be like too obvious to a client. And you're like, we had a thing and now we don't have a thing. You sort of removed it. But that was my experience of researchers in my 20s.
I think others would identify with that experience. I think, yes, it's a stereotype, but there's some truth in that stereotype. So I wish I'd discovered strategy earlier. I think if I had a chance again, I'd probably work in strategy, because just it takes what I enjoy about research, but adds that layer of culture and conversation, which has become, it's been an amazing eye-opening experience for me. So let's move on to the next question, which touches on something that that you raised earlier in this conversation. What behaviors, if any, within the group make people feel uncomfortable or unsafe? And this was the eye of the storm, you know, in early July when you were spending your 10, 20 hours, you know, interacting, moderating, talking to people directly. And we all saw a lot of this. And it was at that time a reflection of what was going on, and things have, I guess, calmed down to a certain extent. But so interesting to see a group that hitherto and since has become, you know, was more focused on information, become very, very suddenly much more personality driven. And some of the negatives that that made people feel uncomfortable include, and some of the words that coming out in the research were one-upmanship. There was posturing. There was a lot of aggressiveness. There was a lot of leaping to judgment. Someone coined it, you know, felt that it resembled the woke Olympics. It was very performative. I'll take more quotes. The rabbit hole of condescension, the faux edginess, the general tension around whether politics has a place in the group, the sense that you gain status by through your one-upmanship. I'm more intelligent than you. I've got more experience than you. It felt at that time for some people like a reminder of the challenges of working in an agency, those issues, the sexism, the elitism, the sense of superiority of some people, sort of self-assigned superiority that some people had. A space that felt predominantly safe for some people suddenly felt very, very unsafe. There's another theme that came through a lot, which I think is worth pointing out, where during that period, some people felt that a small number of voices became really, really dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And that discouraged other voices from speaking up. And in turn, that then challenged some of the sense of inclusiveness and plurality that people get and want from the group.
Yeah.
There were certain personalities who had more than their, some people felt more than their share of fair voice. So the quote here is, the louder the loud ones get, the quieter others became. Mm-hmm. There may be a perceived power dynamic that makes the quieter one shy away from active involvement or participation in debates.
Yeah, there were behaviors that didn't exist in the group for 2.5 years, as far as I'm concerned, that just kicked off overnight around the time of the protests. And then you see debates happening and behavior happening. And you're like, I know you got that quote from a particular podcast you listened to. You got it from that particular thinker. Like, we're just mimicking the stuff that's out in the real world, which is not what this place was about. Then I would also see stuff, and apologies if I contributed to any of it, I try not to. like I was having phone calls with people that I'd never spoken to, like, what's all this about? Then there were also new people coming in. And what frustrates me with a community like this is that you trust it, right? And I do believe that communities self-moderate. You know, I've seen some pretty poor behavior in the hip-hop graffiti community online. Like, that can get quite aggressive. I've started now online in general, but sometimes in the group, just checking my watch to see, is it maybe a bit after dark where that person is? Might they have been drinking? Are they constantly just shooting off stuff at people? And then there's this vibe, which I really don't like, which is someone might join the group and then just flare up, try to burn the place down, take people with it, and then leave. And it's like, what was that? You know, it's something that I had more faith in people. And sometimes they would try to take me with them. I get all these accusatory things of being like authoritarian, where I'm like, what, you just threatened a person and I said, don't do it. Is that authoritarian? Because I haven't had to do it in 2.5 years and I feel conflicted in having to do that. But it seems like a reasonable human wouldn't have communicated like that. And then that's when I'm like, okay, is there a mental health thing going on? Like, how do we keep each other safe? So it was weird for a handful of people to pull me personally into it. Sorry, I have to think about how does that affect me? It's how our brains are wired. And then I was like, whoa, this has not happened in 2.5 years. I deleted fewer than 10 posts, probably blocked fewer than 10 people. And it was just people who weren't real, trying to come in as like made up names and things like that. So that was strange. And then there was a lot of piling on going on. And some people just couldn't let a thing go. And I've said this repeatedly, anything to do with gender, race, mental health, and politics and religion is going to just get the worst out of people, you know? And on diversity, that's why with the podcast, and I don't keep count of what, I have a diversity count for the people I've interviewed. Like I try to keep in mind and mix things up. Usually just people I know that I find interesting, but I don't get into diversity topics unless someone says they want to. I don't even use the word diversity. Like, I don't get into those topics unless someone says, you know what, I will talk about mental health, or I will talk about being a black woman in advertising and how that feels, or I will talk about being a mother, or I'll talk about being transgender or across. You know, there are people I've interviewed, for example, who, one of whom is a drag queen. I didn't bring it up because I didn't ask if they wanted to bring it up. They brought it up towards the end. And, you know, I always really liked how Trevor Noah took over The Daily Show, where it just overnight, it mostly went to just different people who weren't white men. You know, not that Jon Stewart was all about white men, but it just happened. It wasn't explicit. You just lived it. And I think through the Black Lives Matter movement and what was happening in the group, first, important to wake up to those issues. I've been around hip hop for ages. And then you're seeing people, I think like Ice Cube or Ice-T saying, wow, people are finally taking things seriously that I've talked about for 30 years. It's kind of embarrassing, to be honest. And then you look into the history of it. And obviously, while you're looking into the history of it and reading research about the black experience in America, people in the Ukraine, you don't get it. Someone in rural England in the group, you're not going to get it. You're just not going to get someone in Asia who feels like they get excluded by the white man or whatever. You're not going to get that experience. And it's not okay to kind of put them all together. We can treat them independently. But personally, because the black experience here has been formed by slavery and for decades and decades, and it still happens that people like black Americans are marginalized. They're not allowed to vote. They get arrested. They get put in jail in certain parts. Like, there's academic research on this. It's a thing, and it needs to be taken seriously and separately. And also, we need to take the other groups of people seriously as well. That's not being woke. That's science. That's research. And that's what frustrates me with all of this, that because you're compassionate or because you want to care about other people, it doesn't mean that you're doing identity politics. It doesn't mean that you're being woke until you're doing identity politics, right? And until you're being woke. But yeah, you are waking up, but you're not like, and so you just see those dynamics in Sweathead saddened me. And honestly, there was a week there where I was like, I'm going to close it down and maybe reboot it, because there are people coming in here who don't have any of the history or context, who don't know us, and they're just popping off, and I bet they disappear. And you know what? Most of them have disappeared. It was honestly super sad. The thing that I was trying not to take, like in a thing that's abstract to me, that's out there on the internet, that I knew collected people who would send me long emails and messages about it being a beautiful place, to then see it pop off like that and to see people try to burn it down and to drag me with it personally because I'm a white man. I was like, no, like too much.
How do you feel about that now, Mark, 5 months from the eye of the storm? Do you feel that sort of sense of, you know, the things not going in the right direction? Has it righted itself? Are there any traces that of that still got going on in the group?
So I turned on post pre-approval, which I didn't want to do, but now I approve posts. We're hitting close to 15,000 people. There are sometimes 10 to 15 posts in a day. Sometimes there'll be a day with only a couple. And, you know, I'm seeing criticism, because the weird thing is when you see people on the internet that you know talk about Sweathead or use your name, and you're like, hey, I thought we were friends. What happened there? It's like, why didn't you just ask me what's going on? And they would put people down who are asking for help fast. And I'm like, you don't understand. Like, I've met a lot of these people. They're literally by themselves, a lot of them getting abused in the workplace. So they come here and they might not even care if you've got a link to a thing. You know why they're there? So people can see them. That is what's going on. And you talk about empathy, you're not showing it, because that's number one, what's going on. Give them a link, cool. But you know what would have been good for them? Just to realize that they got to interact with, have their little avatar seen by people like them. That's what's going on with a lot of people. So pre-approval, we turned on 3 or 4 weeks ago. Engagement rates have dropped a little bit. I'm keeping an eye on it now just because we're doing an end of year, annual, like a first annual report looking at some of the numbers. But it feels more gentle. I interact with about 10% of the posts as they come through, and I ask people to, first of all, not just drop links in. People were using it as a content marketing thing. That is, here's the thing I wrote. Okay, cool. And the thing is, Facebook doesn't reward that, and people don't click on it. And a few of them would get clicked on and interacted with, but it just makes the place feel, you know, it lowers the value of the place. One of the other things is I've tightened up the rules, which I didn't even have properly or much of or care about or think about until this year. And I just want people to ask clear and compelling questions. So, you know, does anybody have a great campaign? Not a useful question. People will spend time helping you put some time into the actual question. So I do feel it's better right now. I'm interacting with it several hours a day. And at the same time as this has come out, and for me, my book's come out, I'm getting anonymous takedowns in places like Fishbowl and on Twitter and all kinds of places. Some people I know who just flipped on me some people I've tried to talk about mental health with, and then they just flip and I'm like, what is it? It's drinking time? Okay, cool. And so I'm spending more time in Sweat and less in other places right now, knowing I want to get into my next, like own my own project, my, probably another book, fiction. So I do feel it's better. But that phase, it saddened me and it for the behavior, but also I know that I can't, this is where it feels narcissistic or egotistical, where I'm like, I know I can try to help do something better and more meaningful here while feeling burnt out and not fully equipped and not super like logistics and operationally oriented. So I have these moments where I'm like, I know we can do something here. And then I'm like, fuck, I need support. I don't know how to do, like, even though I was a producer. So these things cause a lot of conflict in me. But I went from sad, trying to be compassionate, while also getting personally taken down in places, like just ridiculous flagrant stuff, to quite enjoying it. And I know you're asking about me and we're talking about the community and I'm now talking about me because it's all kind of connected for me, sorry. Mm-hmm. But I get, you know, I might get like trolled a couple of times a month, sometimes in pretty savage ways, which is nothing compared to some of the people in this community. It's nothing, I know that, especially women who are public on the internet. It sticks with you. But then you know what? Every day I get messages and long emails from people who've listened to a chat like this, who've read a book, my book. I say a book, self-deprecation. Maybe it's performative self-deprecation. I've got to get over it. Who've read my book, who've gotten jobs from Sweathead. And I'm like, that's actually what matters. That's my deathbed. I have deathbed tests or questions I would ask on a deathbed. And this currently is important work to me. And I know that we're not allowed to take ourselves seriously and take strategy seriously or take things we make seriously, but it's important. And I want it to be a good place because I don't know about you, I've spent years lost before this industry and in the industry. And so just to have a community around where you can compare notes is really, really important. And like I said before, I know Sweathead's not the only place this happens. And it doesn't need to be. Get it where you can. Set up your own thing. It's amazing. But I do feel it's on the right track. And if anything, just seeing, you know, obviously a big election year in the US as well. So most of the social media platforms are disgusting right now. You know, I have larger questions about where does Sweathead happen in the future? How does it happen in a way? I want it to be a relatively peaceful experience, even if people are having dangerous conversations. So I've got bigger things in my head that are ticking over. But there was a moment when it was ticking off where I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to reboot this thing because there are people in here who do not have good intentions. And some of them I spoke to and I'm like, okay, you're just like, it's malicious.
I think you get to a point and the community, the Facebook community got to that point some time ago where you've got to, you know, tipping point or maybe you cross a chasm, you know, where actually it's impossible to own it. Completely, it's impossible for one person or any person to completely own it, and it genuinely takes on a life of its own. Some of the stuff you've told me makes me sad. It's not surprising because when you have a community of 20,000 people, and when someone puts someone out, themselves out there in the way that you have, I suppose you kind of do expect it, but then when you hear about it and when you talk about it like that, it's saddening that why should anybody have to subject themselves to that sort of abuse? Nobody should have to deal with that sort of abuse. And it puzzles me that you have to, but the fact that you do it, and I think one of the things that is worth me pointing out as well is that there's a whole silent majority of people who are getting value from this community and from Sweathead who aren't necessarily telling you that, right? Yeah. And the ones who are abusing you are the ones that they've got too much share of voice.
Well, also I see them in different platforms and some of them I've met, and I'll check in with people who've introduced me to them and be like, I don't feel safe in this interaction. What's going on here? And it's like 0.5%. The hard thing, the thing that the baggage that I bring to all of this, and I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't have this baggage, is internalizing low self-worth at a young age, feeling that I was always in the, when my family split, feeling that I was always in the way of whatever their lives were, being very isolated, traveling 2 hours from one house to the other, not having a lot of safety in the main house where I grew up. Mom had a lot of trauma going on and, is also an eccentric, colorful personality. Then through graffiti, I used to carry weapons as a teenager, and I'm a little meek kid. I'm a poetry kid. I'm not a tough guy. I did martial arts for 10 years. I'm not tough. I'm not putting a tough. I had to work out how to look back then, at least, someone that was just not worth messing with. That's it. That was my goal. But I was not violent, but I had a lot of, threatened by cops, all that kind of stuff. In the hip hop community, you're getting threatened because I did radio and magazine. You're getting threatened because you didn't play someone's music. And people are getting hit or bottled at events. And so I came through that looking like this and being this soft little nerdy poetry kid. And so when people bring that energy to me in this industry, it's really confusing because a lot of us have survived some shit to be here in the first place. A lot of us, not all. And people will be like, they'll project a thing onto you and based on how you look. And I bring this, right? So I get all of that. And also I see my kids, they're mixed race and they're wrestling with whiteness. And in New York, they get called Asian and Trump got put in, they're getting slinky, like chinky eyes, comments and all this kind of stuff all the time. And this is active in all parts of my life. But then to kind of try to create a safe place and to not want to be authoritarian and then to see that behavior, it got to me. And at the same time, what I've realized is I study my own behavior to get behavior change. So I've had one drink in 6 months, and I did that through a weekend of studying alcohol. I'm like, okay, I don't think I want to drink anymore, especially at home. This is ridiculous. Studied it for a weekend, stopped. And as some of the trolling's been happening, it's just weird because I kind of know them, or I know their bosses, and I'm like, why would you do that? Like, your name's on that, or usually it's anonymous. Then I studied it. I'm studying it. I think of friends. So I've got a friend, Natalie Tran, who interned for me. She was top 10, a Vietnamese-Australian, top 10 YouTube for years. She's had some horrible stuff written about her online. You know, I interviewed Emma Sue, who's an award-winning community manager at EA Games last week on Sweathead from Australia in Seattle. Same deal, you know. And I'm like, because of this, I've survived. But also, I've survived some shit to do it. And if I didn't survive that shit, I wouldn't do it. I'd be like formal strategy guy, I'd be wearing suits and like, here's that. And I'm like, nah, we're talking about like how to be creative in spite of everyone around you not wanting you to change in life. Okay, we'll talk about creative risk for 5 minutes. And I know I'm going a bit long here, but I've not talked about it before like this. So I appreciate you asking, and I apologize for indulging my own feelings.
No, this is why we're having this conversation, Mark, actually, because I think people want to hear it. I think a lot of this, I'm aware of some of it, and I think the group and the community is in some ways it is a mirror of you, isn't it? It reflects you and it reflects those tensions. And I think it's good to have this on the record. This is why you're doing it, and this is what you're all about, because the group, Sweathead, the brand, and you are all part of the same thing.
They are. It still feels very self-indulgent and narcissistic to talk about it. And the only other thing I'd add, just to make it a little bit more dramatic, is like I wake up most days and I try to think, like, what am I here to do? And I think of the people in Sweathead. You know, I watch The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. It's awesome. My kids play a lot of chess at a super high level, so I'm like relating to it for a variety of reasons. But something like The Queen's Gambit, that fits in the Sweathead universe. It's people with these overactive, sensitive brains who are trying to work out how to live, often through trauma. And I'm not saying everybody has to have trauma to be a strategist. I'm not saying that, like, I'm not fetishizing it. It's just that I talk to people. Most people go through stuff more than we know, or more than admit it. And so, like the rest of my life right now, the way I'm thinking of it is trying to help people who think for a living live. That's what I'm trying to do. And I know it's simple language, a bit there, but they are these empathetic, intuitive, creative people who often just get dominated by the wrong people. And they don't get a chance to express. And then they have high hopes of expressing through an advertising career, and they might, but it's not going to be enough because that won't last. And so the ultimate act of creativity is what you're starting to do now. It's like, how do I want to exist? We live in a capitalistic society. I'm talking way too long. We live in a capitalistic society. So for you, being independent, being self-employed, working out how you want to work, that is a creative act. It's self-expression through currently a company, because company, capitalism, earn money. That's the system. But yeah, it's, again, I've not talked, like, I'm used to people not listening to me, which might come across deeply ironic unless I do podcasts or on stage. People don't actually listen to me that much. And so that's why when people bring this kind of more aggressive energy. It's odd because I know violence. I know what that is. And that's not what Sweathead's about. And that's not what this community is about. That's not what I am about. I deal with thoughts all the time, like a lot of us.
Where does it come from? Where do you think this energy comes from? What motivates these people?
I mean, a lot of it just comes from anger and resentment and acting out, right? That they want to be taken seriously, that they had a bad boss situation. And so they act out, they want to take people down. Some people are just wired that way. Like a lot of people who are trolls, which is partly what we're talking about, some people just love, they see it as a game, but it's how they're wired.
Is it just for the kicks, for the lols, the attention? Why is it directed at you and Sweathead? Of all the places and people to troll, why troll you?
Because I'm out there. Like you just, you know, we barely know ourselves, and so when someone wants to take you down, who doesn't know you, or they describe you in ways that are objectively as possible, not true. All they're doing is assembling the negative parts of you that they probably feel in themselves. And sometimes if I see a name attached to it, I'm like, we've talked about your drinking. We've talked about your mental health. We've talked about how you've lost 3 jobs in a row. We've talked about how miserable you are. We've talked about how your interaction with your partner and how they expect you to earn money and you hate all your bosses. And now you're like acting out on me on the internet. Okay. Like I have enough data on that. It still gets to me. I wish you didn't do it. Whatever. And also at some point, we're just caricatures, you know, strategy is your words. I could take the piss out of that. I'm Australian. That's the name of my book. I could totally take the piss out of that. I could take the piss out of myself. Like, it's easy. There's no skill in that. The skill is to not do that and to find the thing that's interesting in the person or in the idea and to try to support them. And that's where I try to be more often than not. And sometimes this community, and I mean this community, not just a Sweathead, but all the communities of these people, that's where I can be that and do that in a way where I catch up with a guy for a beer, even though I don't drink. We'll get into a little bit, not that much, you know, like, so I think a lot of it just comes down, they're wired that way and they like hurting people, or you kind of get this mixture of resentment and anger. And rather than feeling bad, like sitting with it and thinking about why they feel that way and how to change it, they're like, fuck that person. I'm going to take that person down. I'm going to burn the place down on my way out as well. So there's those things. Where do you think it comes from?
I think that there are people who have negativity and certain energy for which they need to find an outlet. What I cannot understand is why would you direct it at someone like yourself and a Sweathead? There are so many other outlets that are more obvious outlets. Why direct it at a community of strategists and at the person who set up that community? I don't know, but then I'm not them. You know, it's
also really unpredictable. You know, there are definitely groups of people. So, for example, there are swathes of people who seem to be more logic-oriented. But, you know, if someone's logic-oriented, they're in a big role in a big place and they've gone to Oxford and I see, you know, and they might say something about Sweathead, for example. I'm like, I just don't think you get to say that. I just don't think you get to have that point of view. You don't understand what's going on with these people who are super often very isolated, not supported. They're just trying to live or trying to be seen that day. It might not even be about the question that they're asking. So there's that kind of person as well. And then there's also, you know, there's a different appreciation for people doing things. And I feel like the US is a freer place to experience that. The UK, oh no, get in line, know your place. Don't clap too much. Don't smile too much when you go do talks, right? There's a different vibe. And there's definitely, people say this, I've seen it. Might be a small group, but in the UK, there's definitely like an Oxford, Cambridge, common room, white male vibe in places, which is the banter of put down, intellectual put down, but from a place of coming from super privileged, like crazy privileged families, right? That's a small group. I'm bouncing around a bit because I've not really put words to this into someone else's face, because at some point, you know, what is actually important is to keep going.
Yeah, definitely.
That's all that matters. People are going to come in and out of your life. They're going to come in and out of your community. They're going to come in and out of your business. You just got to keep going because you're the one who has to look at yourself in the morning.
Keep doing what you think is right. And I think the success of the group and the growth of the group speaks for itself. The value that it's giving to people may not be something that is expressed on a daily basis, but it's there. You know, that silent majority is there, and the fact that people, just looking at the research, you know, the intensity of the emotion that was felt towards that community is a reflection of how important and valuable that community is to people. So back to the Facebook community. What's next? What might we expect to see in the future?
Yeah, well, I mean, initially just tightening it up. Obviously, over summer, I launched sweathead.com membership, $10 a month. There are 100 classes there. You know, I want to build that out. I was holding off on that as well, but then all my events got cancelled this year, and I thought, let's give that a go. I wanted it to be accessible again because I've been to Bombay. I know $10 a month's a lot, and I want the people I met there to be able to do it, as opposed to I could totally charge hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars for the stuff that's up. So I want to build it out. I do want to build Sweathead into something that's sustainable and profitable as a business. I made a hip-hop magazine once. It was not profitable. That's why it didn't last. And then there are bigger philosophical questions. You know, could I bring people into the company? Is there a way for other people to have equity? Because if we talk about diversity and inclusion, it is great to include voices. It's great to have people who look different in the room. But I totally buy into the idea that it's actually about sharing of power. I don't know what that looks like for what I'm doing, because the thing needs to survive and idealism can get in the way. And I'm learning about this space and going slowly. But really right now, just trying to tighten up the Facebook group and knowing that a lot of people are going through difficult times right now, thinking about are there ways that we can put on programs to help people, you know, come out of unemployment or at least learn through unemployment and really build Sweathead into something that's bigger and sustainable, because I love it. Obviously the main questions are like, what's the business model going forward, ownership model, and then where could it come to life?
Can I point out a couple of thoughts from the groups in terms of what some of the people in the research talked about as possible things they would like to see?
Yep.
I think there's I don't know if tension is the right word, but there's certainly a dynamic going on between a place where people are nice to each other versus also a place where people can have those challenging, dangerous conversations. And I think we saw it perhaps veer in one direction earlier in the year, but that's a constant dynamic that exists within the group. And I don't think there's a clear answer to that. But at the same time, we're trying to create a safe space, but we're trying to create a safe space for people to be honest and to be weird. And, that's a fundamentally challenging thing to do. And it's more challenging, I think, the bigger the group gets. There's a quote here which I quite like, actually. Aim for respect rather than safety. Safety perhaps isn't the right way to think about it. Safety might connotate the quietening of certain voices or certain points of view or certain opinions. If people feel respected, the right kind of safety arises. And that links to the idea of maintaining those and allowing those dangerous conversations to thrive.
Yeah, I think safety to me is not violent. So I agree with the definition that you just mentioned there. But to me, it's just like, I'm not going to get personally attacked. That's it. And by I mean, we are not going to get personally attacked. So that makes sense. The other thing is, you know, Facebook, like I've worked with Facebook, I've got friends at Facebook. There are people from Facebook in the group. You know, I was curious to see how they would handle the elections because, you know, people are leaving. A lot of people are leaving Facebook. They don't want to be on it that much. So that also gets caught up in this a little as well. And it's a difficult user experience. You know, if we do a live stream, where's that? You know, how do I find the thing? You know, and they're aware of this. And their game, their bet is groups, at least in the short term, because of what happened with everyone seeing their uncles and aunties posting political stuff in the feed. You know, they're going to prioritize the groups. But that's a thing that I'm thinking about. Slowly. And then also, because a lot of it's in public, we also, you know, I've organized tens and tens of Zoom chats where we'll have 10 to 50 people turn up and talk about some of these topics. And what I believe, I don't know if you feel this now because with your experience, it's like, I don't feel that I've got like that much to lose. I'm not going to be reckless with it, but I know what feeling repressed to me feels like. Everyone's repression is different, and my repression was just what was around me, and I wasn't expressing, I wasn't doing what I needed to do, and I won't do that again. I'm going to express. And so I feel like I've got a little less to lose. And so if I want to post something like 500 words on not drinking or on depression or on various, there are a few topics that I've gone through that I probably wouldn't put in the group necessarily, but I feel like not everybody has to have the dangerous conversation, but that it's important for a few of us who feel that we've got less to lose to do it, because it can be life-changing in a way that you don't realize until a few years later. And it's often that silent majority. And maybe you help them understand a partner that was going through some rough times, or a brother or a sister or a niece or a nephew who was struggling. And they're like, okay, that person took a bit of a risk there. And I'm not glorifying what I do. I just, for me, I've thought a lot about not being alive, right? And so also that's where a lot of this energy, this is life energy for me. And so when people shit on it, I'm like, oh, I was just working out how to be alive here. Like, what's going on? Stop shitting on me. And so, yeah, the dangerous conversations are important. One thing that I've noticed is that even with the podcast, like, I've interviewed people with more to lose, big titles and big jobs in London, New York, and we can get into some really deep topics where I won't always push, but if they go there, open up the door, we'll go in. They would not have done that 10 years ago. Their bosses never would have done that. And so we are part of a cultural change. You know, we're pushing it a little bit. And I think more of the establishment organizations are going to have to work out how to be more extreme in their own event and training material, their own programming. They're going to have to work out how to be more extreme, but in extreme for them, more candid. And so I love seeing that. Like, every now and then a big organization will do something that's like, you'll see a title for an event, you know, and it's like plain English and it's dealing with a topic they wouldn't usually touch. And I'm like, that's awesome. Good on you. And it's because of all these little communities trying to have these conversations that they would now feel safer doing it. 10 years ago, no way in hell. It would be, here's how to learn about the four C's, framework 1, 2, 3, 4, how to do research. That's it. Now it's like, yeah, we're burning out because we're working in abusive workplaces, aren't we? We should do something about that. So I do feel there's a bit of an opening up that's going on that allows dangerous conversations to happen. But a lot of people have higher stakes, you know, and so I want to acknowledge that too.
I think this, for me, there's something really powerful there around opening up your perspectives and providing a window into the lived experiences of people that perhaps are hard for you to experience in any other way. Again, I come back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier. What opportunities might you have to understand what life is like, you know, in another country for another person? Actually, not that many, particularly right now when no one's traveling. And for me personally, it was really understanding Black Lives Matter and why it was what it became in the United States. And, you know, I got that from the group at a much deeper level than I got from any other source of information and media. But it could also be, as you say, it could also be mental health. It could be what it's like to, you know, to be a woman experiencing prejudice within the work environment. These are things that I think people do turn to the group for, and there are conversations in the group that you don't necessarily get exposed to in many other places, which I think are valuable. You know, for someone like me sitting in a privileged position in London with, you know, the luck that I have to be able to do, you know, to work for myself, you know, there are all these things going on that I wouldn't possibly imagine and know. And actually, Sweathead is one of the places that gives me that window.
That's awesome. That's absolutely what it's there for. So I said you were going to do all the talking today, and I ended up, but also, you know, thanks for allowing me to have the space. I know I could just turn on the microphone and talk about this stuff, but it is nice to have a human who's also channeling 100 other humans through the research to talk about this stuff with. Final thoughts about the research that, like, what surprised you most? What did you enjoy most about it? Simple baby questions for you.
I think the strength of feeling, as I alluded to earlier, that the level of equity that the brand and the group has in people's minds, you know, which it has for me, and I know it has for a lot of other people, really came through in the research. You know, there's a lot of love for the community. There's a real desire for the community to thrive. And for me, it really underscored the quality of the people in the communities. You know, some of the quotes that I've shared, some of the language, some of the thinking, is stuff that you just rarely see. You know, you rarely see it in research. You know, it's in many ways it's easy to do research with strategists, because strategists give you the answers already. You don't have to dig too hard into the research to find the answers. You know, the answers are there for you, you know, couched in incredibly articulate, well-phrased words. I would love to do this again, or, you know, I'd love if Sweathead could do it again. I know you're doing a survey for your annual report, but I think as an example of how communities evolve, for an example of, you know, some of these topics, which for many of us, as you say, we don't have an outlet in many other places in the world, you know, and that's why I think the community, you know, is dear to us, because it represents that outlet. It represents our people. It represents us, you know, and all the weirdness, you know, and craziness that we are, in a way that you know, it's difficult to find. You know, we can be ourselves in that community. You know, so I would love to see more research done. I'd love to see you know, more people, you know, come in and discover what the group's all about. And who knows if we'll see something, you know, along the lines of what happened earlier this year. But despite the pain and, you know, all I think, you know, the negativity around that, I think there were also, you know, there was value that came out of that experience. I think the group came out of that experience with insight.
Yeah, I agree. And also, so thank you for that. I'd love to do some more research. I bet that's how you end every meeting, Stephen. But I want to be in a better position to execute. I sometimes disappear into these holes of book writing or class making, and they're very emotional holes for me, and I can be there a while, and then I'm like, oh, I've got to take care of these other things, and should I create an advisory board? Should I, you know, there's so many questions I've got about it, and I kind of need to get into a better place or bring someone in to help me operate. But be in a better place to actually execute the stuff through the research. And I also want to say that I kind of, maybe you're curious about it as well, centered my own emotion. I want to acknowledge the fact that I did speak to a lot of people in the group, and especially Black strategists or people who are in advertising who are Black Americans or even, you know, Asian Americans. And their pain it's way deeper than whatever I expressed. And that's why I was like, who am I to even talk about being upset about an online Facebook group? What? You know, I talked to people who felt that they were getting abused in the workplace anyway. And then they would see on the news people like them being shot by cops, and to then go to a workplace that didn't know how to deal with it or didn't want to acknowledge it or would deal with it in a tokenistic way or would make some bullshit ad without actual change. Like, that pain is way more, it's just way more. So I just want to make sure that people feel seen with that. And you don't get to call that woke. You don't get to put that down as being woke. You just don't get to do it. It's to call that kind of stuff woke is to me be inhumane. This world would be a better place if we tried to understand each other. And that's what a lot of us spend our lives doing through strategy. All I'm saying is sometimes you do have to turn that torch back onto yourself and try to understand yourself a little bit more and try to take responsibility for yourself, and probably for a lot of us to try to live more expressive, more creative lives. Or, you know what, go live in the woods, whatever. Most of you are going to go to the woods and be like, I need to do something, I need to create. So, Stephen, thank you so much for being patient and making this happen. Big shout out to the 100 or so people who joined the focus groups to take part in this. I hope you'll do that with us again. I'm always open to ideas. I interact with so many people every day, and I still have this barrier of this thing being a thing, as in Sweathead being a thing. It's like, it's weird for me to take that seriously. It's a hurdle that I'm trying to get over, because like, I do feel the energy. The negativity's gotten to me a bit, but like everyone, dealing with rough family and friend health news, right? Or four of us in a two-bedroom apartment that we're fortunate enough to be able to pay for. But like, I think I'm ending in a sad and optimistic way, in that whenever I have interactions with people from, broadly speaking, this thinking community, not Sweathead, but broader, I always feel really uplifted. I feel like they're often very gentle and delicate, introspective interactions. And I joke with people every now and then and try to push them. Like, when are you going to write a book? When are you going to run for president? When are you going to do a thing? Because I just know that as they hit their 40s, they're going to have to have thought about that, because many of them won't have full-time jobs if they're currently full-time employees after that in this industry, because it doesn't last that long. It's just being honest. It's not being cynical. Hopefully we can all change it. But they have beautiful, gentle talks. And so, Stephen, thank you so much for making
this
happen.
Thank you for what you do. Keep doing it, please.
Oh, gosh, this did turn into a therapy session, which is like what I do, Stephen. But thank you for joining me on Sweathead today, Stephen.
Thanks for having me on.
Peace.